I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Big news this morning. The U.S. Department of Agriculture will be relocating two research agencies to the Kansas City area. We'll find out the reasons for the move, what that means in the way of jobs and office space, and why some think moving these agencies here is a bad idea. Then Missouri and several other states will be working to bring Roe v. Wade back in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, and there are questions arising because of it. Today, a conversation about abortion and the ethical and constitutional rights that come with it, from rights of the fetus to control of a woman's reproductive choices. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Today we'll wade into the tough ethical and constitutional questions surrounding abortion with our ethics professors. But first, the Kansas City area scored a major coup this morning with the announcement that hundreds of well-paying federal jobs are on their way here after the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced the relocation of two research agencies here. Headed here are the new headquarters of the Economic Research Service and the National Institute of Food and Agriculture. The two rank as the department's key research agencies and have been called the crown jewels of the USDA. Exactly where the employees will work remains a question. Among the sites mentioned are Crown Center and the Sprint Campus out in Overland Park. The move doesn't come without controversy, although federal officials who backed the move said it brings the agencies closer to the farmers they serve. Others point out that the move will require long-time employees to uproot families and move across the country. It also will undermine collaboration with other federal agencies based in the nation's capital. Joining us to talk about this big development today are Tim Cowden. He's chief executive of the Kansas City Area Development Council. Tim, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Also here is Frank Morris of KCUR, who's been covering this story. Frank, nice to have you.
Hi, Steve.
Also, we have comments from members of Congress, Emmanuel Cleaver and Charisse Davids, and we hope to hear from Kansas Senator Pat Roberts, who's chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee. Tim, why is this such a big deal for our area?
Well, anytime you move 568 well-paid scientific and research jobs from anywhere to your community, it's a huge deal. The average salaries are well over $100,000. So the impact that this will have on our region is significant.
Were we the favorite all along here, Tim, given our standing in the middle of farm country here?
I wouldn't say we were a favorite at all. I mean, Steve, you have to consider that last fall we were one of 136 communities and regions across the country that submitted letters of interest in the project. Then after around the first of the year, they cut that to 60. And then about 6 weeks ago, we found out that we were one of three, and there were two backup locations. So the final three were Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, the Research Triangle, mm-hmm. very formidable opponent. Also Indianapolis, in particular the campus of Purdue University, which is one of the leading land-grant universities in the country, and then Kansas City. And two backup sites were Madison, Wisconsin, and St. Louis. So the competition was stiff, but certainly we believe that we have significant assets here that we brought to bear, and we put forth a very compelling message that obviously was received well by the USDA.
You know, you've called these research agencies, Tim, the crown jewels of the USDA. What do you mean by that?
Steve, the individuals within these two agencies really are the brain trust of the USDA. So anything and everything that has to do with scientific research, economic forecasting, that's what occurs within these two agencies. So again, for these agencies to be now in the middle of the country, in the middle of the agricultural belt, in the heartland, is significant. Could have gone anywhere in the country, obviously, with the two other locations that were finalists, both very, very formidable competitors. You look at this decision and the fact that they're bringing more or less the intellectual capital of the USDA to Kansas City, that is a big, big deal.
When's this going to happen, Tim?
Well, the final decision should be on a location, should be sometime within the next couple of months.
You say final decision. Isn't today the final decision?
Final decision on a location within Kansas City will be within the next couple of months. The decision has been made for Kansas City. Let's be clear about that.
Right.
Secondly, as they move through, they will be bringing employees here starting later on this summer. So their employees will need to be in Kansas City this fall. So it is moving at light speed, certainly for projects, and we are moving along in lockstep with the USDA throughout the entire process.
You know, Frank Morris, again, of KCUR, this seems like a pretty natural fit for our area, which already touts its animal research capacity. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, we've got the largest concentration of, or at least the Animal Health Corridor claims to have the largest concentration of businesses making not only pharmaceutical products, but other kinds of animal health products in the world. We've got something like 5,000 USDA employees already here, a big federal workforce. So, I mean, there are definitely some reasons to, and you know, close proximity to MBATH, the big research facility going on in Manhattan, or going in Manhattan, federal research facility. So there are synergies here. There are reasons to, and not to mention, and you know, a dozen or so land-grant universities within driving distance of here.
You know, you've been covering this story for a while now. How surprised are you that Kansas City won this thing, Frank?
Well, I'm not all that surprised. I actually do think that Kansas City was a leading candidate it was talked about as a leading candidate after they called the first list of, over 100 locations.
Tim Cowden, again, chief executive of the Kansas City Area Development Council. Why does the Trump administration want to move these agencies to begin with? And whose idea was this? Who was pushing it?
Well, I would say that anytime organizations, first off, you want to get closer to your customers or your stakeholders. So I think there's a motivation to do that. This happens all the time in the private sector. Companies move to be in locations that can gain greater economic efficiencies for the company. In this case, it'll be for the federal government, and certainly to be closer to their customer base. So our organization works with companies from across the country and from around the world daily. And this is a popular refrain: get closer to my customers and reduce costs. So I believe that is ultimately the motivation of this move.
But again, agriculture happens everywhere. Why not put this in North Carolina? Why not put this in Indiana?
Well, I'd say, Steve, that we made the most compelling case why it should be in Kansas City. So over the course of the last several months, we've been building a case, and when they brought, the USDA brought their executive team here and their consultants about 3 weeks ago, we made an excellent case as to why Kansas City and the Animal Health Corridor should be the location for these two agencies of the USDA. And I agree with Frank. The Animal Health Corridor is a significant strategic advantage for Kansas City. Kim Young and her team sit three offices down the hall from me. They're part of our organization. And I'd like to stress that during the entire process, to be able to have our congressional delegation from both sides of the state line, all four U.S. senators, all of our House members, both governors, all on the same page, all supporting a Kansas City location, was quite powerful and compelling. And I got off the phone this morning with one of the leaders of the USDA, and he told me that was a significant rationale as to why they selected Kansas City, because they knew there was a seamless process in place, that we were going to make it simpler and more efficient for them to move quickly to locate in Kansas City, and that's exactly what we've done.
I was going to say, Senator Roberts has been talking about this notion that this united front that the Kansas City area put forward here was key to bringing this thing out here. We're not known for being united on much of anything, Tim. Why did it happen here?
Well, I might push back a little bit on that. This organization has been around for 43 years, And our job is to make those lines go away. So every day we're working with companies and decision makers that are evaluating Kansas City against other markets across the country. And they would tell you that is a very simple place to evaluate and to do business. So in this case, we are able to do it in a very visible and public way with the USDA. So I'm excited about the fact, obviously, that the USDA selected Kansas City, but during the process, we've been able to show what we do every day, that Kansas City is one region. We do work together, and when it counts, we can make it worth everyone's while.
Tim, I know our time with you is short, but I just want to get in one more question here. This notion of where these federal workers are going to toil their trade. I know several sites have been mentioned here, the Sprint Center, Crown Center downtown, the Quality Hill, it's different areas. Is this question still up in the air somewhat?
It definitely is up in the air. You mentioned Sprint Center. I think you referred to the Sprint campus.
Sprint campus, I'm sorry.
But there are multiple options, viable options in the Kansas City region that are still under consideration by USDA leadership. They will be moving very quickly to make a decision on where they locate. But that was, again, one of the main reasons why we made it to the final three, is that we had viable office space options for them to consider. So that's a very, very important consideration. They have choice. So they'll make a decision in due time, and until then, we'll work with them to build up the best case for their employees and their families. Kansas City, as we know, is a welcoming, warm community, and we can't wait to express that to those employees and their families that will be moving here.
So this is going to be a good summer for real estate agents here in the area, Tim. Do I have that right?
Steve, I think you are right on with that, my friend.
Maybe you and I should think about that business this summer. is there going to be a tussle between Kansas, the Kansas side and the Missouri side to land these positions?
Well, you know what? There's always competition in a marketplace. And one of the things that I loved about this entire process, again, was the fact that both governors who were in my office 3 weeks ago making pitches to the USDA executive team, they said, each one of them said, hey, we want you in our states, of course, but we want you in the region first. So now there will be a competition between Kansas and Missouri and between these buildings and other communities, just like there is for every project that we work and in every market in the country. That's a free marketplace. We're all excited, though, that they have selected the Kansas City region, and everybody can agree upon that.
Okay, that's Tim Cowden, Chief Executive of the Kansas City Area Development Council. Tim, thanks for indulging me for an extra couple minutes here. I sure appreciate it.
Steve, thank you. Frank, you as well.
And congratulations, Tim. You bet.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, speaking of where these jobs are going to be, Kansas Democratic Congresswoman Charisse Davids was talking about that very point to KCUR's Kyle Palmer this morning. Let's listen to what she had to say here.
Actually, when I talked to the folks over at USDA this morning, I definitely made the pitch for why the 3rd District is best situated. I think it's going to be one of the best places to attract and maintain folks who are going to be excited about not just the research that they're doing that's going to be helpful to everyone, but also that, you know, their kids are going to be going to top-notch public schools, that, you know, the Johnson County, Wyandotte County, the 3rd District in Kansas is just it's a great place to raise a family.
No question, Frank Morris. There's going to be a big tussle behind the scenes here over exactly where these jobs land.
So, yeah.
I think Tim Cowden is spot on with that.
That's true. Yeah. You know, and Steve, I guess I'd like to say that there's kind of a context too. There's a backstory here that isn't as rosy because this move, as Tim said, is happening at lightning speed. It's been very abrupt. And a lot of people in Washington, especially in former heads of these agencies, current employees, say it is a way to force attrition at these agencies without having to cut the butt, because they are popular agencies. They do good work. They are The Trump administration has been somewhat hostile to them, though. There's a guy called the chief scientist who is supposed to oversee them. Secretary Perdue's first pick for chief scientist was a radio show host, believe it or not. Second pick was a guy from Dow Chemical, an executive. The Trump administration has proposed cutting these agencies, ERS especially, in half each time they've had a chance to write a budget. And so this move has already triggered a bunch of resignations at the ERS and NIFA, the National Institute for Food and Research. People, who have these jobs are sought after, and they can work in D.C., so they don't have to relocate. They can go take another research job. So the way this is being done, very, very abruptly, and then you see this again today, we're going to have these people in place by fall.
That's remarkable speed for the federal government.
And both these organizations just unionized in the last month to try to slow this down and try to ultimately stop it, but to try to slow it down. There's opposition in Congress as well. Tim said, and it's part of the justification, you want to be close to your customers. Well, their customers aren't really farmers and ranchers. Their customers are policymakers, and they work closely with other researchers in the Washington, D.C. area. So by moving them out here, it removes them. And again, these are agencies that track climate change, which the Trump administration doesn't believe in. And they do research on tariffs, the effect of tariffs on farmers, the economic advantages of the food stamp program, things that the Trump administration does not that don't square with Trump administration, that their research doesn't square always with Trump administration political policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, as seen in that context, is hostile to those agencies that are moving out here. But Kimberly Young, is going to do her, at the Animal Health Corridor, is going to do her best to make sure that these people are welcomed and their spouses find jobs and they find housing. So they're going to roll out the red carpet here. But I think it's important to understand that the context from a D.C. perspective is that this move is hostile to these agencies.
Well, let's go with this notion of controversy here, Frank, and we'll talk to Mark Lavender now. He's Senior Manager of Government Affairs for the Union of Concerned Scientists. Mark, good morning.
Hey, it's good to be here. My name is Mike.
Mike, I'm sorry, Mike.
Yeah. That's all right.
We've been moving fast here this morning. Well, Mike, what's your greatest concern about this relocation of these agencies out here to the heartland?
So we are strong supporters of agriculture research year in and year out, and the Farm Bill and the appropriations process here in Congress. We're always advocating for increased investment in agriculture research because we know agriculture research invests in food safety and invests in rural economies and farmers and ranchers in all 50 states. And so the lens that we're approaching this with, the relocation, is how does this improve agriculture research, food and agriculture research?
Right.
For the entire country. And I think that is the question. Just before I hopped on, you were mentioning the consistent budget cuts that Secretary Perdue has proposed to USDA research just in the past couple of years. To us, that doesn't look like someone who believes in the strong investment, believes in agriculture research and the benefits that it can bring. So we're concerned that this move will actually be a diminishment of food and agriculture research because USDA hasn't been able to prove how this will actually improve agriculture research. And I think, frankly, I know there's a lot of excitement from folks on your show and in the region and some of your listeners, but if you're in Maine, if you're in North Dakota, if you're in Kentucky, if you're in any number of other states, you're probably looking at this and saying, well, wait a second. I have farmers. I have ranchers. I have important agricultural constituencies in my state. How does this benefit me? And that gets back to the point that ERS and NIFA conduct research that's in the national interest.
Mm-hmm.
And this doesn't necessarily support research in the national interest. We want to support all farmers. We want to support all ranchers and eaters and consumers across the country. It's not clear this does that. And so there's a lot of problems with that.
Mike, what about staff and folks who are going to have to uproot and move halfway across the country? Are we seeing people balking at that? Key scientists, key researchers saying, uh-uh. What's your sense of it?
There have been multiple dozens, even probably more than dozens of USDA staff who have explicitly already left USDA because of this relocation process. Up until the relocation process was announced in August of 2018, there wasn't a staffing problem at USDA. There wasn't a staffing problem in these agencies. In fact, these agencies, ERS and NIFA, were high functioning and doing their work really well. So the concept that one of the main justifications that has been given for the relocation is we need to be able to recruit highly qualified staff better. We need to move so we can recruit highly qualified staff. That doesn't stand up to a breath of wind. That has not been proven that that was a problem that needed to be fixed. So we're already losing key staff, and these are staff that are doing research. You know, you mentioned earlier research on climate, research on food safety, research on farmers and ranchers. But importantly, these are also the same staff that help get grants out to research institutions across the country, land grant institutions, including those in Kansas, Missouri, and elsewhere. So with the loss of staff that we've already seen, and we'll probably see an even greater loss of staff now that this announcement is official, there are going to be real ramifications to agriculture research this year and in the near future. And to us, that doesn't look like something that actually supports agriculture research, supports farmers.
Right.
Again, we want to be increasing investment, not creating these disruptions. We don't want to be reducing productivity. And so none of these things add up to improving agriculture research.
So bottom line here, this for us, Mike, is this move of these agencies away from Washington out to the Kansas City area a way to diminish sort of the impact that these agencies have had on federal policy going forward?
I think that's certainly within the realm of consideration. I mean, look, frankly, it's not clear why USDA wants to make this move, because all of the justifications they've given for wanting to move, they haven't been able to prove. And so the great fear here is that if you look at how Secretary Perdue, his budget proposals have suggested cutting hundreds of millions of dollars from USDA research. Again, that's not a signal you would want to get from someone who you think supports agriculture research. So if you couple that with the vagueness of this relocation proposal, keep in mind, I don't know if it's been mentioned yet, this relocation and reorganization proposal was developed without any stakeholder input, any stakeholder input. So there was no process to say, work with the stakeholder community, farmers or the research community, that this was a good thing to do. You want to talk about doing things behind closed doors and without input from people? This is the epitome of that. So they're ramming through a process that they developed behind closed doors without any proven benefit. Right. So I think there's real concern here. Yes, this is going to diminish American food and agriculture research at a time when China is out investing us. China now invests more in agriculture research than the United States does. And we're getting consistent signals from Secretary Perdue and this administration that they do not support agriculture research. And that's concerning.
That's Mike Lavender, again, Senior Manager of Government Affairs for the Union of Concerned Scientists. Mike, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Finally, on this topic this morning, House Democrats in Washington have vowed to block this move. How realistic is that? Because I know Congressman Emanuel Cleaver from this area is committed to the project. Here's Congressman Cleaver again speaking to KCUR's Kyle Palmer this morning.
So you have all of the delegations from Maryland and Virginia joining forces to stop this. And you never know how it's going to turn out. You know, in many ways, I hate to be in conflict with my Democratic colleagues, many of whom are very, very close friends. And so I don't blame them for doing it, and I hope they understand that I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that this thing happens.
You know, Frank, the tenor of our conversation today has been that this is a done deal. These jobs are coming to Kansas City. Do you expect any roadblock from Congress that would possibly stymie this thing, or do you think this thing's going to happen?
I think it is going to happen. I mean, there has been moves to try to cut, to refuse funding for this move, to try to, you know, block it in various ways. The union has some negotiating power. They might be able to slow things down, try to get a little bit longer window to decide. Once you get the relocation letter, right now it's going to be a month. You have to decide yes or no. You're going to go to Kansas City. They want to have, you know, more visits built into that process, longer time. As far as I can tell, it looks like a done deal. There's one little bit of news today. The secretary Perdue never tried to justify the cost savings that he was talking about today. He threw out a number, $300 million in savings over 15 years. There's no data to back that up, but that's what they figure they'll save by moving these agencies here instead of paying high rents in D.C.
Okay. That's KCUR's Frank Morris on this big move of two federal ag agencies, research agencies, out to the Kansas City area. That news broke here this morning. Frank, thanks for your time as always.
You bet, Steve.
Time for a break here. We come back, the ethical and legal questions that Americans struggle with when it comes to abortion. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, NPR, Sarah McCammon is a political correspondent who's reported on the Trump administration, mass shootings, and abortion. She'll be here in the studio tomorrow. Join us for that conversation. Well, the 1973 Roe versus Wade ruling guaranteed a woman's right to an abortion, but you wouldn't know it after the latest round of laws passed in state capitals placed dramatic limits on that right. In Missouri, Governor Mike Parson recently signed a bill that criminalizes abortion in the state after 8 weeks of pregnancy. That's often before most women would even know they're pregnant. These moves raise a number of ethical and constitutional questions. Among them, what are the ethics of granting rights to a fetus? And whatever happened to a woman's right to privacy? That was a key factor in the court's ruling in the Roe case. We're not debating abortion this morning. Rather, we're navigating ethical and legal issues surrounding it. And with us to discuss this, Edward Cantu is a professor of constitutional law at the UMKC School of Law. Professor, nice to have you back again.
Thanks.
Welcome.
Good to be here.
Deborah Williams is a professor of environmental science and biology at Johnson County Community College and a lecturer at the University of Kansas School of Law. Professor Williams, nice to have you here, too. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Professor Williams, remind us what the Roe decision actually said, just in a few sentences here. What came down in that ruling?
Well, it's actually, in my view, a little bit difficult to distill it down into something other than it's a perspective on the woman's right to secure an abortion. It basically looked at the gestational sequence and divided it into a trimester period. Mm-hmm. And then there were a series of ethical and legal analyses around what's happening in those three-month blocks in three parts of the nine-month sequence. And you have, you know, a balancing of rights between the mother's rights and the potential fetal rights. Ultimately, where we landed, it was that there's a legal term that was introduced called viability.
That was my next question here. What does that word mean, viability?
Well, it's in legal terms, it's the state, it's the threshold at which fetal rights can attach, where you have some limitations on the women's privacy and autonomy rights to choose an abortion. You start to see more of a state compelling interest in prohibiting abortion at that point in the late stages of fetal development.
Right. Edward, this notion of privacy that played into the Roe versus Wade ruling back in 1973 was central to the deciding of this case. Explain that to us.
Well, this is the court meant privacy in a kind of narrow way. So they didn't mean privacy in the lay sense of the term. Basically, what they mean by privacy is a basic personal autonomy. the right to make certain basic decisions about one's personal life, and they use the term privacy for that. So that basic natural rights idea is still the central idea in the court's abortion jurisprudence, even if they use different terminology.
So. Yeah, Professor Canty, I was going to say, you don't hear that word privacy kicked around much these days in the context of the abortion controversy as all these different states pass abortion restrictions. Why not? What happened to that idea?
You know, honestly, I haven't even noticed that. But assuming that's true, I think it's probably because the word privacy is kind of useless in this context. For the reason that we're not really talking about privacy in the sort of intuitive lay sense.
Yeah.
We're talking more about personal autonomy or what's often called personhood rights. That relate to just sort of natural rights notions about what individuals with dignity ought to be able to do without interference from the government. So.
Yeah. Deborah Williams, again, in the Roe decision, the Supreme Court still left all kinds of discretion to the individual states. And I'm wondering, like what?
Well, before I answer that, I'll go back to something that I think needs some clarity here. When a discussion of the ethics of abortion cannot occur in isolation without an understanding that it also entails science and also entails law. And so I was reminded when Professor Cantu was speaking that Voltaire famously said, if you're going to converse with me, first define your terms. And so we throw around terms like privacy and think everyone understands what that means, or viability and think that everyone understands what that means. These have they're terms of art in law, but they have scientific and legal gravitas, and I think it's important to go back and spend some time appreciating at least the plain meaning of the words, but also the connotations or the public perception of what those laws would mean. But
how about discretion left to the states?
Well, and that's where we are. We see, making headlines today that, if you have the discretion has been left to the state on states on these issues, and you're seeing states attempting various things with regard to that prerogative.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure Professor Cantu can give us a rundown of the variations. But in general, we've seen over the past couple of weeks some very aggressive moves made by certain states in terms of attempting to ban abortion or limit a woman's right to seek an abortion. And then we've seen kind of the pendulum swing the other way and having states freeing up abilities in kind of in a commensurate response to that. So I think we are seeing now playing out in the public domain a lot of different options with that prerogative, and used to say where we're going to land in terms of a legal precedential effect that we have on the books right now, Roe v. Wade, and other supportive cases after the fact that have given us guidance from 1973 forward that can inform our discussion today.
Edward Cantu, the other issue that seems to have evolved over the years is this idea of granting rights to a fetus.
Mm-hmm.
How has that idea evolved? Can you walk us through that and where we are today?
Well, if we think about law, overwhelmingly is premised in the moral standards of a given community. And obviously, for understandable reasons, even if you don't agree with them, there are going to be a lot of people who think that just because a child is not yet born, it is still a life, it is still special, and it has certain rights, and therefore aborting it is immoral. That's what they would argue, obviously. If a community believes that, it's going to pass laws consistent with that belief, and that's going to run, straight into people who want to abort and don't agree with that premise.
And the law today says what when it comes to the rights of a fetus?
Well, the law doesn't really say anything about that. What the law in a case called Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and to some extent in Roe v. Wade, the court rightly dodged the question of whether an unborn child is a person for purposes of constitutional law rights attaching to it.
Well, why would the court dodge that central question? Is that sort of like the founding fathers dodging the question of slavery, and the fight continues for decades and decades and leads to a civil war?
I think the court understood that ultimately what is a life is a metaphysical question, not a scientific one.
Ah.
We often think of it as a scientific issue because the sciences do define life for purposes of physical sciences, but not for the broader purpose of metaphysically defining what life is generally. And so the court understood that it had no competence in deciding that for purposes of constitutional law.
Okay.
So instead what it did is it focused on the rights of states. It said, okay, we can't say that this is a person with rights, but we do know that a community does reasonably have an interest in the potentiality of life.
And that community is a state to decide for itself how it wants to approach that issue.
Correct, yes.
And that's what's led to all these different laws being passed across the country in recent months that Deborah just mentioned.
As well as the interest in protecting the health and life of the mother, which is ostensibly, anyway, the basis for this, a lot of the regulations that we've seen come out.
So how do judges weigh questions like this? I mean, is it based on science or emotion? I mean, is it possible to keep the emotion out of a question like this, Deborah?
You know, it's an excellent question. And, you know, especially with cases of first impression where you have, you know, what we see often in bioethics and law, often you'll see a turning to the ethical literature, a turning to scientific literature, the medical literature to try to inform. And I think that's a good thing, that because of my earlier statement, nothing, science doesn't exist in a vacuum. Ethics doesn't exist in a vacuum. Ideally, laws and policies are informed by both. And the best way to ensure that is to have these open dialogues and have an awareness of that, hey, you know, this is a, has a legal dimension, but we're talking about a living organism, or we're talking about an entity that has aspects that maybe my legal training doesn't equip me to best address. I'll pull from another expertise area in order to inform that. So I think we're back to that. My answer to your earlier question would have been a little bit different. I would say maybe the reason why the court didn't answer that question as to whether personhood attaches is because it's difficult to determine the features or the feature of personhood. We do have ethical literature. We have ethics professors who have attempted, and we George Fletcher is one. I use it in my bioethics and law course and my introduction to bioethics course at the undergraduate level. And I have this great quote, and that's right in front of me, from Fletcher, where he talks about attributes of personhood. And the quote is, "Ethics is precisely the business of rational critical reflection, encephalic and not merely visceral, about problems of the moral agent in biology, medicine, as much as in law, government, education, or anything else." So what he's arguing for is, we may not get it exactly right in terms of defining a term, but our term should be operational. There should be some force and effect if we're going to say that the point at which legal or moral rights attach is X, then have some way of gauging that, of enforcing that, of consistently applying that. And in order to do that, I think you have to step back and look at, you know, what the definition itself is implying, what the definition, where the definition can take you, and the implications of that beyond the conversation at hand.
You know, Edward Cantu, going back to the Roe ruling from 73 and Harry Blackmun's writing here, you know, some scholars have said the Supreme Court was wrong to create this pre-viability, post-viability standard in the first place. Do you guys agree with that? Was there a better route available to the justices at the time?
I think that the viability line was primarily emphasized in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, but it did come up in Roe as well. There are several problems with it. It is sort of arbitrary, but at the same time, and the court, to its credit, admits this in its Planned Parenthood opinion, we have to draw a line somewhere. Where do we draw it? And viability seems like just as good as any other place to draw the line.
And this notion, as Sandra Day O'Connor once pointed out, of what is viable and what's not, that line is changing.
Yes, with technology.
As technology advances and a fetus can survive, now a newborn can survive for fewer, you know, more quickly than they used to be able to survive. And things are changing all the time.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Just to add to that, this is where the scientific angle can maybe be helpful. To say that, and some will argue that, you know, life begins at conception, or that, you know, rights should attach at conception. I mean, it's as a biological fact, cells are living. They're the basic living of all living, the basic unit of all living things. It's not particularly interesting or dispositive to the conversation, but to move that a little bit forward and say maybe it's not about starting at the earliest place, but looking at a composite, an aggregate of functionalities, which is why, you know, one of the controversial current perspectives on abortion is, you know, when there's a fetal heartbeat. To me, that seems like an arbitrary scientific, you know, line to draw. You know, why not lung capacity or why not kidney function? And I think if we unpack that a little bit more, there's something about, you know, heart or the connotations of...
So it's political, you're saying.
It's political, it's moral. Emotional, it's all of the things that Fletcher is arguing that we shouldn't be. We should be encephalic, we should be cognitive, we should be objective, we should be rational, we shouldn't be visceral.
Which has proven to be utterly impossible when it comes to this debate.
Right. Yeah. You don't have to divorce yourself from the emotionality of it, but it's important not to center your focus entirely on it either.
Edward Cantu, help me understand something here, because in Missouri, Governor Parson just signed this bill that criminalizes abortion in the state after 8 weeks of pregnancy. As I said, that's often before most women would even know they're pregnant. So here's what I'm wondering. If that's the case, how would that pass legal muster in a country where Roe protected the right to an abortion?
It's not. It is a law that is intentionally made to violate Roe so that they will have standing to challenge Roe in the U.S. Supreme Court.
To see what the court says about abortion today.
Correct.
As opposed back in 1973.
These laws are blatantly unconstitutional according to current case law. And so the whole point is so that someone will come along, get ticked off and challenge it so that now they'll have a court fight and hopefully get Roe overruled.
Okay. Yeah. Let's go to a phone call here. Let's go to Ken from Liberty. Ken, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
I don't really have a question. I'd like some clarification. A big part of Roe v. Wade was medical self-determination, meaning that the federal government did not have the right to step in and tell you what to do with your body, meaning that a woman could get an abortion based on that because the federal government couldn't say you couldn't have one. Now, what about could the federal government, let's say in the situation that Roe v. Wade was turned over, would the government be able to force you to give blood? Would the federal government be able to force you to donate blood, to take your DNA samples for whatever reason it wanted to?
Right. And let me get some reactions here from our guests. Edward, Deborah, who wants to jump?
I'm happy to.
Yeah.
Would the federal government be able to do that? Well, if the court overruled Roe v. Wade, what would happen is it wouldn't say that the federal government is now empowered to do X. It would simply say that now the states are empowered to do X. So it would go back to the states, which incidentally means that a lot of states would probably keep it legal. And some states, a lot of states would not, obviously. Mm-hmm. So, but it wouldn't mean the end to abortion in America. But that's a very different thing than saying that the federal government would now have the ability to do anything to your body that it wants. That's quite a leap. In fact, taking what was the example he gave? Blood.
Giving blood.
Blood. Yeah. I mean, the court has repeatedly dealt with that under the Fourth Amendment and has said that that constitutes a search under the Fourth Amendment and requires a warrant. So there are all sorts of things at play here that would keep an overruling of Roe from going to its sort of nefarious logical extension.
Yeah. Deborah Williams, is that your belief too about what the court might do here?
Yeah, I guess I was going back and rehashing in my mind, Roe v. Wade. But I think the caller's characterization that it was sort of an open license to have an abortion isn't entirely correct. You have go back to that, you know, draw a line and divide it into thirds. You know, you have up to the point of viability a lot of discretion by the mother with limited state intrusion. But after that late term phase, and that's when you start to see more of a restriction on freedoms by the state intervention, unless it's, you know, life or health of the mother.
Right.
So we have to start with that clarification. But no, I would agree that you would see probably a gamut of responses by the states, as we're seeing right now in these test cases where it's just trying to provoke maybe a social conversation or provoke a potential legal challenge in the future. I think we're starting to see states respond differently, and as that can be, that's predictable.
That's the voice of Deborah Williams, again, a professor of environmental science and biology at Johnson County Community College, a lecturer at the University of Kansas School of Law. Thanks for your time, Deborah. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Edward Cantu, a professor of constitutional law at the UMKC School of Law. Always good to have you too, Edward. Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and some fun stuff to do this weekend. Chuck is in love.
In the pool hall, well, is he here? I look in the drugstore.
Well, look who's here, Brian McTavish, and look who's in town in the next few days, Ricky Lee Jones. Boy, and she doesn't tour that much anymore, I don't think. This is a moment, right?
I've read where she's a road warrior, but she hasn't made it back here.
Back to Kansas City,
right?
What I
it's meant. Been yeah. Word on the street is that it's been since 1982.
Wow!
Since Ricky Lee Jones. Now Chucky, he's still in love, and Ricky Lee Jones
let's hope so
knows where to find him. Chucky's in love. That was her biggest hit, really first and biggest hit, breakout hit in 1979. Let's get this out of the way. If you haven't seen her, and you probably haven't if you're from Kansas City, or even if you were lucky enough to catch her in 82, check her out. 8 o'clock, Sunday night at Crossroads KC at Grinders. She is a singular singer-songwriter. She is the 1980 Grammy winner for Best New Artist, and she has a new album in which she does covers. They can't resist. I mean, even somebody who's such a great songwriter and is so super
cool. It's hard for me to believe that she would do covers.
Well, I guess it's a dollar sign, right?
Yeah,
I guess it's a dollar sign. But she's the perfect person to do it because no matter what she attaches herself to, it comes out as her highly personal pop voice. I mean, you could call it soul jazz. You could call it any number of things. But you will probably hear this weekend, this Sunday night at Crossroads KC, her do some of these songs off her new album, Kicks. Kicks. These are the songs that gave her kicks, jazz and pop standards over the years. She covers Bad Company, which Bad Company did. That was a clever song by them back in the 70s. She does Dean Martin's Houston. She does a version of Mack the Knife. And finally, she does this version of You're Nobody Till Somebody Loves You, which is great. Now, that's a sentiment which may not actually be true because everybody is somebody, right?
Yes.
But it's irresistible in her hands because it's great for pondering purposes. And she may well be the ponderer in chief. Ricky Lee Jones, Sunday night at Crossroads KC.
Let's talk Shakespeare.
Let's talk The Sound of Love. Is that The Sound of Love?
It comes pretty close.
Okay.
I got a better version, but we'll talk about it some other time.
Will we? Okay. Yeah. I promise to listen very intently. Okay. It's the 2018 Heart of America Shakespeare Festival with a big twist because this year they're doing a stage version of Shakespeare in Love.
Huh.
Which was, what was that, huh?
That was a big hit.
How about, huh?
Yeah,
It was the 1998 Academy Award winner for Best Picture, Shakespeare in Love. It's on stage outside there in Southmoreland Park, just a stone's heave from the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. 8 o'clock tonight through Sunday. The show is set during that time when Shakespeare was writing and staging Romeo and Juliet. So this show shows the world's greatest playwright-to-be going through his own fiery love affair. So his love life imitates his art, or is it his art imitating his love life? Methinks it's complicated. But basically, we are to believe through this piece of fiction that this is where Romeo and Juliet came from. He falls in love with this young woman. It's complicated, as I said, but it's so audience-friendly. I mean, it's super accessible. I would call it Shakespearean-style entertainment. You know, somebody might go, enjoy this so much. Maybe it's a stretch. I'm an English major. What can I say? But somebody might see this and go, hey, what about Hamlet? What about Macbeth? Let's go to the bookstore. I know,
okay.
I'm a dreamer. Some may call me a dreamer. Anyway, go check it out. You'll have a great time at Shakespeare in Love this weekend.
Staring in your eyes.
Okay, the big music festival coming up this weekend is Boulevardia.
Well said.
Yes.
You've been listening.
It's big, yes.
Absolutely, yes. It's Boulevardia returns to the Kansas City Stockyards District. We are listening to one of the bands which will hit the stage. They're the Friday night headliner, Young the Giant. So you got your beer. How much beer? Oh, I don't know.
Lots of beer.
Like, you know, what is it? 30 or 40 or 50 different beers?
How many kegs will they go through this weekend? Yeah.
Well,
there's a thought question.
Is a keg the biggest container for beer, or is there, like, something bigger than a keg?
I don't know.
You know, a good place to ask that question would be this weekend at Boulevardia. Anyway, products from more than 50 breweries, food from 30 or more local eateries, dozens of local makers selling their jewelry, clothing, lifestyle goods. There's a cornhole tournament, and that is a tailgating game, right?
I see that on ESPN sometimes, though. It's become a national competition.
Yes, it's a competitive thing. You throw the bean bag into
the
hole on the slightly elevated platform. Tailgaters love it. Anyway, oh, and a carnival. Now, did you ever get stuck at the top of a Ferris wheel?
No, but I'd like to.
Now, did you ever get on a Ferris wheel?
Yes.
Well, I've never been, so I've never been stuck. But this might be the summer for me, and with any luck, I'll get stuck at the top of the Boulevardia Ferris wheel, which would be a twofer. That would be like a two-time first experience thing. It could happen.
Well, it could.
Only if you come with me, though.
Yeah.
You're not going to do that, are you?
I could think of other people to get stuck in.
No. Well, I would panic. I would be a poor choice. I would start panicking.
Yeah, that would not be good.
There could be weeping.
I'd like it up there.
I might make you panic.
No. Okay, this weekend, Boulevardia.
Do it.
Here.
Oh, Little Sound and Vision. It's the Audio Visual Club of Kansas City Charity Gala. This is a little bit different. It's a free-at-the-door fundraiser for area audiovisual artists and students. And this event features an art sale, a silent auction. There's a raffle with really nifty AV-oriented prizes. It's 6 to 10 Saturday. It's free to get in. It's at the Blue Gin Gallery, and I hope I'm saying that right. Go to 1400 Union Avenue in the West Bottoms, and all the money that gets made, not from admission, it's free to get in, but, you know, from the various things they're doing there, the ultimate long-term goal of this is to give the Audiovisual Club of KC a building, a community space where they can literally give locals, access, whether it's a rental or they buy it outright.
They can be audio and visual there.
They can buy a turntable or get a camera or make their 2D dream come true.
Okay.
They can do it.
And finally today...
Forever young, forever young.
That's Dr. Dylan. there.
He has a degree in
In Nobel Peace Prizes, yeah.
In Dylanology. Is he the original Dylanologist? He'd have to be, wouldn't he?
He'd have to be.
Okay, forever young. Well, you know, nobody stays forever young. But the dream is alive this weekend from 11 to 4 in the afternoon on Sunday at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts.
Wow.
3,000 or more, give or take, local youth performers, singers, and dancers will make it happen on 4 stages, right?
Wow.
So what'll you get besides a lot of smiles? Even if you only got a lot of smiles, that would be enough. But, you know, not to
put future Bob Dylan.
Exactly. No pressure on the kids, but you could see somebody who could turn out to be even bigger than they will seem on stage this Sunday afternoon at the Kauffman Center.
And that's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thank you, sir.
I'm still holding out for the Ferris wheel.
Tomorrow on the show, NPR's political correspondent Sarah McCammon will be here. She talks about some of the most controversial issues in the country. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.